ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, this is The Book Show, where if you've recently had your heart broken, I should warn you, we're talking about breakups today. When a relationship ends, what do you do with all the stuff? The furniture and pictures and records you collected, thinking you were going to keep them forever. The Australian author Jonathan Seidler has been thinking about this. His new book is about a woman purging everything via Facebook Marketplace. He's going to join me. Val McDermott is also here to talk about one of the most famous dramatic couples of all time, though perhaps not as you think you know them, Macbeth and his queen. I'm Claire Nichols. It's great to be with you. Val McDermott is here with me today. You know her as a crime writer with her Tony Hill and Karen Piri series. But today we are not talking about a crime novel at all. For her latest book, Val has turned to history, grappling with perhaps the most famous Scottish tale, Macbeth. Val, it's great to have you back on The Book Show.
It's lovely to be back, I have to say. It's always a pleasure talking to you guys.
Your new book is called Queen Macbeth. Tell me, where does Shakespeare's Macbeth sit in the Scottish psyche?
Well, I think it's like everywhere. It's sunk into our psyche as this was a picture of what medieval Scotland was like, and this is a picture of what the people who ran Scotland were like. Bloodthirsty, psychopathic, driven by ambition to do terrible, overreaching things. And it's not a very satisfying picture to have as part of your history. You know, this is what Scotland was like. This is the legacy, if you like, of the past, because it really couldn't be more different.
Really? Okay, so tell me the truth. Starting with, I guess, Lady Macbeth's name, because it wasn't even Lady Macbeth, right?
No, she wasn't. Her name was Gruach. She became Macbeth's wife, or he was actually Macbethad. But I've left them called Macbeth in the book because it's easier for people to get their heads around, I think, than having to come to grips with the fact that he's got a different name and all the rest of it, as well as getting to grips with the medieval life that they led. They were not a bloodthirsty tyrant. They were, in fact, the opposite. They ruled Scotland peacefully for 17 years, which was quite something in those days because thrones changed hands quite often in bloodthirsty ways, usually on the field of battle. Macbeth did not murder Duncan, and Lady Macbeth did not stand there handing him the daggers. It was a battlefield fight where Macbeth killed Duncan in battle, as was, I suppose, a reasonable medieval way of settling things. That was how the throne got passed from hand to hand. In Scotland, the rule of primogeniture didn't really obtain. You had to be in the royal line, but it wasn't the firstborn son who automatically got the throne or the headship of the community. It was passed down to the person who was deemed to be the most appropriate to do it. So it'd be somebody who had an army, somebody who had the right family connections, somebody who had money, usually. And Lady Macbeth, or Macbethad's wife, was not this evil person in the background conspiring with witches to put him on the throne. It just didn't happen that way. But it suited Shakespeare to portray Scotland in that way at that time, because the new king, King James VI of Scotland and First of England, had to be flattered. And he had a bee in his bonnet about witches. So let's throw some horrible witches in there to show the king that we're on the right side as far as that's concerned. And let's show the bad, evil Macbeth, because that's not my king's ancestors. My king's ancestors are Banquo, who comes out of the play quite well. So it was a political move, really.
A PR exercise.
Absolutely, and we're not unfamiliar with those, are we, when it comes to politicians?
I mean, as a Scottish person, do you feel a bit hard done by then by Shakespeare's play and the portrayal of Gruach and Macbethad?
It's quite galling, actually, this portrayal of these two, because at the time Scotland was an unruly place. There were sort of separate kingdoms within what we now think of as Scotland. And in fact, Macbeth united two big kingdoms in Scotland. It was the first step towards modern Scotland happened during his reign. So they were quite the opposite of bloodthirsty tyrants out for what they could get. And it is quite galling to see that image of Scotland being passed around the world, as that's what people think we were like, and probably think we're still like that a bit. There are so many positive stories that can be told about Scotland, and that's one of the ideas behind this series, The Darkland Tales, of which Queen Macbeth is one. The idea is to re-examine these myths and legends and stories about Scotland to see what lies behind them and discover our history properly.
So tell me about this, Darkland Tales. This has been organised by a publisher?
Yes, yeah. Polygon Berlin are doing this, and this is the fifth in the series. They started with Denise Minor writing about Rizzio, who was Mary Queen of Scots' private secretary, who was murdered in Holyrood Palace. And the politics of Denise's version of events is somewhat different from the version we all get about this scheming Italian trying to influence the Queen of Scotland in particular directions. We've explored, in this series, I've explored the Bonnie Prince Charlie's escape after the Battle of Culloden. They've explained the Viking raid on the Western Isles, which meant that the Book of Kells ended up in Kells, not in Iona, where it was originally put together. So it's a way of looking again at the stories that have shaped our history and actually replacing them with, as far as we can, what really happened. I think every country deserves to have an honest part of its history out there in the world. And that's, I think, that the idea behind these is to dispel the myths and get back down to what shaped us, really.
To play devil's advocate, Val, you could say that the truth might not be as good as the story that Shakespeare came up with. Is the real story of Gruach as juicy as what Shakespeare came up with?
I think it's as dramatic, yes. It's got high points and low points. And at the heart of it is a love story. You actually understand, I think, better what happened if you understand the affection, the genuine love between Macbeth and his wife. She wasn't a scheming woman who married him in order to get her hands on the throne of Scotland. She was someone who loved him, and he loved her. They were very close. As I say, they ruled for 17 years together. They went to Rome together on a pilgrimage, holy pilgrimage to see the Pope. They left the land in the hands of a regent. Well, they went away to the other side of the known world, and they came back, and it's still theirs. So, you know, they can't have been that horrible, or there would have been a rebellion against them when they were out of the country.
Tell me how you got involved in this project, Val. We know you as a crime writer. How did you end up being the person to write this retelling of the tale of Macbeth and his wife?
Well, the editor of the series, Jamie Crawford, used to work for Historic Environment Scotland. And while he was there, he edited an anthology called Bloody Scotland, which accompanied the Scottish crime festival Bloody Scotland. And he enlisted a bunch of writers to choose properties that are in the Historic Scotland portfolio and write a short story centred around those. So a bunch of us obviously wrote murderous short stories about these lovely properties all around Scotland. And that's how I came to work with Jamie in the first place. So when he set up Darkland Tales, he approached me and asked if I would like to do Lady Macbeth, and I bit his hand off. I didn't know the whole story back then. I knew very little. All I knew was that it wasn't the way that Shakespeare had told it. So I had to do some research. And there's a lot of we don't know about medieval Scotland, because I completed the first draft of this novel and handed it in. And the publisher at Berlin, Hugh, said, "There's a slight flaw with this. You've got these two characters communicating with each other via notes, but unfortunately there was no paper in Scotland in that time." So I said, what do you mean there was no paper? He said, we didn't have paper in Scotland. The monks wrote on vellum and did their manuscripts on vellum, but people didn't write, they didn't use paper. So I thought, well, that's a bit difficult. How do I communicate? So I had to work out an alternative way of communication, which we did. And I think it works quite well. But that was quite a shock to me. And it explains also why there isn't much recorded history from that period in Scotland. You know, England has the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. It's got the Venerable Bede. It's got the Jarrow Gospels. But we didn't have anything comparable, because we weren't sitting about writing. We were busy trying to stay alive, probably.
So this is outside your wheelhouse, Val. You know, we know you as a crime writer. What was it like to step into this different genre?
Well, it was scary, because it's always scary when you do something that's outside your experience, and also something that obviously there will be historians who have an opinion about this and who may disagree with me on some points. But I've done my job as best I could. I think at the heart of it is storytelling. And storytelling is what I love. And I guess the problem with being a crime writer, if it is a problem, is that you get put into a pigeonhole of that's what you do. And you don't really get the chance to do other things and I suppose, practice other skills. So for me, this was a really exciting project to be part of. It was a challenge. Could I do this? But I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the process of doing what research I could and then the process of imagining it in my head and writing it. That process was much the same as writing a crime novel, I guess, because it's the same process of storytelling, creating characters that you care about and that you hope the reader will care about.
You just don't have to have a dead body on page two, Val.
There are a few dead bodies along the way, but not quite in the same. There's not much of a mystery about how they got dead.
You know, I did pick up this book, despite the title, Queen Macbeth. I did think I was picking up a crime novel, and there probably will be some of your readers who pick this up thinking they're going to get a crime novel. But I enjoyed this so much, and let's get into the story. When it opens, Gruach is living in hiding. Can you just set it up where we are and when we are when this book opens?
Yeah, we're at the beginning of the 11th century in central Scotland. And Gruach is living on an island, small island, in Loch Leven, which is a loch in Fife now. And she's in exile there. She's in hiding. Macbeth is believed to have died at the Battle of Lumphanan. She's kind of on the run, but she's being hidden by the monks, who are faithful to her and Macbeth, because Macbeth granted them the land where their monastery is. So they're in hiding there. They're waiting to find what's happening. Gruach's son, Lulach, is on the throne of Scotland. He is standing against Malcolm, who wants to take over the throne, who has defeated Macbeth in battle, thinks he's in charge of Scotland now. Lulach is the last one standing, but in his absence, she's the only one who can raise an army. Early on in the book, Lulach dies in battle. He's killed. So there is this tremendous pressure on her to stay alive, to be someone who could be a standard bearer against Malcolm. But she has no army at this point. She has no support outside the three women who have been with her since childhood. The condition of her first marriage was that she was allowed to keep her three women by her side. And these are three extraordinary women. They're not witches. One is has strange visions, but that's because she has a mental condition. One is very practical and never sees a problem, but only ever sees a challenge. And Aoife is the one who hunts and who takes care of Ethne the seer. And so this is her and her team. And then Malcolm's men appear, so they have to go on the run.
I love how you emphasised that the three women with Gruach are not witches, because they do have extraordinary powers, extraordinary minds. And of course, we've all read Macbeth and there's three women. We're going to think of three witches, right? Val, like, is this an accident?
No, it's not an accident. I wanted to escape from the idea that you needed supernatural powers to be a powerful woman. I think this is about women finding strength with each other and doing what they have to do to survive, using each other's support. And I think that was very much the case for a lot of, if you read other historical fiction, like Philippa Gregory's books, you see the importance to women in positions of supposed power, queens, ladies, duchesses. They always have around them, they're supporting women, and that's where they found their strength and where they found their safety.
You mentioned Gruach's first marriage. So in this book, we're moving back and forth through time. So we've got her in hiding on this island. Things are looking dicey for her there. And then we go back to when she was previously married and being wooed by a young, handsome Macbeth. Tell me about that story.
Well, she was married off to the Mormaer of Moray. And the Mormaer was the title that was given. It was effectively a king in all but name. And she was married to a man called Gilliam Comegan, who was, by all accounts, quite a brute. She was married off as a political act by her father, securing his own position in the hierarchy at the time. She was herself in the royal line of succession, so she was technically capable of being a queen in her own right, but she was married off to Bailey to keep everybody happy and to secure her father's position. It was not a love match, clearly. And then young Macbeth arrives at the court, and handsome, red-haired, successful, not very rich, not rich in land or money, but he's a very loyal band of men. And they meet and fall in love. Then Gruach's husband and his 50 warrior band men mysteriously die in a terrible fire, which paves the way for Macbeth to woo his widow, which is a love match. I'm not saying anything about how the fire started or what happened there. You could say that's possibly an element of crime and mystery in the book. anyway, it sounds brutal and awful, and it probably was brutal and awful. I mean, life then was probably nasty, brutish and short, as they say. But that was the way things were. That was how things ran in those days. It wasn't a polite sitting around the table and saying, can I get a divorce? Because that didn't really play out that way.
It did strike me in the current story, you know, when she's on that island, she's in so much danger with just those three women and the monks to protect her. But when she was in this marriage to a very powerful man, she was also in a great deal of danger. Her position never feels secure. She doesn't have the freedom to go out and talk to who she wants to talk to. It seems like she lives her whole life, Val, in danger.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think for people of power, not just women of power, in that particular period, you were always looking over your shoulder, wondering who you could trust, wondering where the next threat was coming from. So I think that although they ruled for 17 years in relative peace and safety, there was always a sense of threat. There was the other claimants to the Scottish throne and land. There was the Vikings always lurking in the background. There was the English on your borders, waiting for the moment to strike when they thought they could take their kingdom from you. So it was never a secure position. You could never sit back and smell the roses.
And you mentioned the nervousness about what the historians may make of this book, Queen Macbeth. How much permission did you give yourself, Val, to get creative and fill in the blanks and make things up when it comes to this important story?
Well, what I did was I found out as much as I could about the historical record, about what people wore, what people ate, how their daily lives played out. And then I coloured in the bits between. And things that I wasn't sure about, I read around as much as I could. But I also spoke to historians when I needed to. At one point, I'm describing the food, and I talk about ginger as one of the spices. And someone in the production team said, I don't think they had ginger in Scotland in medieval times. And I said, well, they must have had it because the Romans were there. And the Romans will have brought all sorts of spices and herbs with them. So I went off and I spoke to Mary Beard, the classicist. And I said, what do you think? Would the Romans have brought ginger? And she said, probably. No one can argue against it. So we have ginger in there. So where I could find out stuff, I found it out. And there are a couple of really good source books. There's a great podcast called Gone Medieval, which I listened to quite a lot. It covers the whole Middle Ages, but they've got quite a lot of stuff on the early Middle Ages. And that filled in a lot of the day-to-day blanks for me of what people were wearing and what they were eating and what they thought about sex and what they thought about relationships. So I did what I could and then made up the rest.
I love hearing about the ginger. It reminds me that the last time you and I talked, we spoke a lot about Scottish food and you were making YouTube videos at that time with recipes from your books. It seems we always come back to food when we're chatting, Val.
Wonder why that is.
Because food is great. What does it mean to you to have this version of Lady Macbeth's story out in the world of Gruach's story? Does it feel good to be correcting the record?
It does feel good, actually. It feels good to give a different set of images about Scotland's past to young people, because we don't hear enough about proper Scottish history. We get these great romantic myths and legends, you know, Bonnie Prince Charlie escaping over the heather dressed as a woman and all this kind of stuff, which obscures the very important elements of our past, the kind of country Scotland was, how we lived, how we shaped our future. You need to know about your history before you can create a future, I think. And at the moment, you know, there's a lot of pressure still for independence. And I think to be an independent nation, you have to understand your history.
Is it back to crime for you now, Val McDermott?
It is, yes. I'm writing another Karen Perry novel. So that's quite safe territory. I know what happens in 2024.
Well, look, I really enjoyed going back to the 11th century with you. Your book is called Queen Macbeth. It's published by Polygon. Val, thanks for your time.
It's a pleasure, Claire. Thank you.
this next book has had me reminiscing about breakups. You know, when you're in the depths of a breakup, it can feel like a pain that will just never go away. But of course, time moves on, and so do you. But for me, these memories came hurtling back with this book, All the Beautiful Things You Love, by the Australian author Jonathan Seidler. It's about a couple, Ellie and Enzo, who have split up after a decade together. And it's about the stuff that defined their relationship. Jonathan, it's great to meet you.
And you.
So there's a great epigraph at the start of this book. It says, "One of love's greatest drawbacks is that, for a while at least, it is in danger of making us seriously happy." Tell me about that epigraph.
Yeah, so it's Alain de Botton, who I discovered when I was in my final year of high school. I was actually on Schoolies in Byron reading, I think it's Essays in Love that that's taken from, which is just a really strange thing to be reading when everybody else is like drunk and out of the pub. But I just remember really getting into his writing and just thinking that he encapsulated a lot of the dynamics of relationships in a really interesting way, and coming at it from a philosophical background, I thought was great. But what I really loved about this quote, which actually had to stand in for a quote from Laura Marling because I couldn't get it cleared, was it kind of talks to that idea that when you are in the midst of a relationship, you think that there is nothing outside of it and nothing will ever change and this is it and this is your entire life. And in reality, the rest of your world kind of shrinks to the size of that relationship. And then when you're on the outside of it, you realize that that was never actually the case. So I just thought that he encapsulated that perfectly.
And one day I will have a chat on this show specifically about getting the rights to epigraphs, because that is a whole thing in itself. But tell me now, Jonathan, why write a breakup story?
Oh, look, I mean, I am a big lover of love stories. And I think you can't really write a love story unless you're writing a breakup story, because they do go hand in hand. And the best love stories are sometimes breakup stories. That's kind of what I grew up watching and reading. It's always just been interesting to me. I got dumped a heap of times between the ages of like 16 and I don't know, 31. So I had a personal experience. But I also think that looking at the end of a relationship is where the interesting stuff starts to happen. I feel like those really fairy tale love stories don't really get underneath the fingernails, as it were, of what a relationship is about. And that to me is where you actually find out why people fall in love and why they fall out of love.
What? So when they're kind of raking through the remains of a relationship, they can understand themselves better? Is that what you mean?
I think so, yeah. I do think that you don't really understand a relationship if all you get is the rose-coloured glasses version of it. You know, if that's all that you're seeing in reality, then you're only seeing, I guess, like 30% of what makes up a relationship. Relationships are full of imperfections, not to quote that annoying John Legend song. But they are, and it is those dynamics that make them interesting and also make them unique. There are things that bind us when we read about other people's relationships and relationships in general, but there are unique points that you kind of sometimes only find out when they end, because a lot of relationships do end. And I think that's an important thing for us to interrogate, because you remember why you're in love in the first place.
Reading this book, I remembered how debilitating a breakup can be. I think you do forget as time goes on how in those weeks and months after a breakup, you can't cope. I mean, how bad can it get? How bad has it been for you?
It's been pretty bad. I left the country.
Yep, I did that too. Yep.
And when I left the country, I met my wife in the country I went to. So I guess that was good. But yeah, I was completely floored. I really didn't see that one coming. I've had a few that have kind of knocked me for six where they just came out of left field, and other times where I think both of us were dragging out the relationship because we felt like we didn't know how to end it, which I think is quite common as well. And those ones can sometimes be harder because you feel really terrible about it, but in actuality, it was the right decision the whole time. Those ones where you kind of wake up in the morning and someone's at your door going, yeah, this is over, and the entire life that you've been building for 2 or 3 years or whatever is done. Particularly when you get towards your 30s and, you know, you start thinking about children and stuff like that, the stakes get higher. Mm. So yeah, I think those ones can be very, very devastating.
Mm. And then I guess there's the problem of all the stuff you've collected together, all those pieces that remind you of the missing person, of the relationship. I mean, how much sentiment do you attach to the stuff in your life?
That's a very funny question. I actually was writing an article about this the other day because somebody asked me about that. And I went back to my mum's house and found a box full of old love letters. Like, I'm talking chock full of stuff from like year five onwards.
Wow.
A3 Valentine's Day cards, 1 month anniversary. Like, you know, when you were dating people and you give them like 1 month anniversary presents, that kind of stuff. Like, I have all of it. I keep a lot of stuff, and maybe that's why I'm qualified to write a book like this. I'm not really sure, but I am not a hoarder, but I'm somebody who really attaches sentimentality to things and use them as a leaping off point to talk about relationships that I've been in. I think all relationships, even when they end badly, are positive learning experiences. And I think keeping the stuff or the treatise, as it were, of a relationship sometimes helps with that. But, you know, there are obviously limits. I live in a small apartment and have a child.
Yeah. I mean, I'm probably more of a purger, you know, like, got to get rid of everything, got to get rid of all the memories. This book was originally called Marketplace, Jonathan. So just tell me about the setup, the idea here behind this book.
Yeah, so the idea essentially is that a couple have been together for 10 years, so their entire 20s, which is a very formative time when you're a young person. They get married at the end of their 20s and then they break up. And they break up quite quickly. I guess that's the first type of breakup that we were talking about. And we open the book with Ellie, the protagonist, realizing that her husband is leaving her and that she's left alone in her flat with all of the stuff that they've collected over the last 10 years. And she sits down on the couch, realizes that she's going to be paying double rent on a flat that she can't afford, and also that she doesn't want these memories hanging about, and decides to sell off every single item on Facebook Marketplace, which was a rich and illustrious seam from which to pull, because Marketplace is full of some very interesting people.
So she's going to sell one item and she's going to meet the person who she's selling it to. And in what might only happen in fiction, but I hope happens in real life, these people she sells to, you know, she's going to end up sitting down and having a glass of wine with them, and she's going to learn things from them. I mean, where were you finding these kind of characters that were going to help her on her journey?
I mean, some are inspired by real life, not very many of them, but there, I did have one experience. My wife and I lived in a flat in London and we had to pack up very quickly because we had to get back to Australia before the borders closed. And we were basically trying to flog stuff extremely quickly. I think we were doing on a Gumtree at the time, but I had these two guys come to get a couch that my wife had, and they just sat and chatted to me for like an hour. It was unbelievable. I couldn't get them out of the house. It just kind of got me thinking, like, maybe there are lots of people having these conversations. We've made friends with people we've picked up like baby stuff from. Like, it does happen. But the rest of them are just out of the dome, really.
It's lovely to think that in 2024 or in 2020, I guess, people will still just sit down and chat with a stranger. You make yourself quite vulnerable in a way doing that.
I think Facebook Marketplace in particular, because it's attached to a profile that is social and that for a lot of people back then was still open, it's quite different to something like Gumtree, where basically everyone's anonymous and, you know, you show up, you might get a name or a phone number, but it doesn't really feel intimate. Facebook Marketplace, it's like you've got their face, you can click through and find out at least perfunctory information about that person. So it does feel, and there's that messaging service, which, you know, the other ones have, but I don't know, you're inside the Facebook algorithm and you're using that technology. So there was something that was really rich in there that I thought was quite unique, and that made for the beginnings of that kind of story.
Tell me a bit more about Ellie and Enzo, who these two people are.
Yeah, so Ellie is a Mancunian. I've spent some time in Manchester. My wife is from Manchester. They're lovely people and very different from people from London, which my wife is at great pains to remind me of all the time. And it's true, they're much nicer. She comes from a very interesting background. Her mother was a model whose career was cut short by a car accident, and her father is a doctor.
And just to be clear, we're talking about Ellie here, not your wife.
Ellie, not my wife. Yeah. I mean, my wife is beautiful. Just putting that on air right now. And she's 6 foot tall. She only wears black, and she's an interior designer. And Enzo is an Italian transplant. He's from Naples. He is significantly shorter than Ellie is. He is a journalist. He works in financial services journalism, but not like the sexy stuff. He does kind of those dossiers for brands and companies that need information on people who are rich and what they're doing with their money. He's a bit of a nervous wreck, though he never tells anybody about it. And he's addicted to grime music, which is a form of UK rap music, which I also love. So that was quite easy to write.
And people will be getting maybe a little bit lost here, because We should make it very clear that this story is set in London, despite your thick Australian accent there, Jonathan. Tell us, you've obviously lived there, but tell us about taking the step to set this novel in a place which is not your own.
Yes, that was a very conscious decision for me. I wrote a memoir a couple of years ago, which was extremely Sydney-focused. I'm from Sydney, and it was about my relationship with my father and my family and history of mental health in my family. And it was like just so Sydney-focused and so Australia-based that I felt like I couldn't really go anywhere else with it. When I'm talking about something like fiction, I really like to travel. I like to imagine. I like to kind of close my eyes and take myself somewhere else. I don't think that I could do that in the place in which I live, but I can do that in somewhere where I have lived. I know the particular area that I write about, which is East London, almost like the back of my hand. I rode my bike around that area for 2 years every single day. I could tell you what's happening on what street, you know, which cafe is still there. I've been back at it, you know, I can remember it almost from memory. It's almost like I'm a cab driver in some ways. And I just think that it's really amazing to be able to write in other places. I've always wanted to do that. It's just, from an imagination standpoint, it's much more interesting to me. And particularly when you're talking about fiction, I just wanted to be somewhere else. And I wanted to situate those characters somewhere else. And also, frankly, there are much more interesting characters in East London sometimes than there are in Sydney.
And I think also, you know, this is a story about love and relationships. And by putting it in London, I started thinking of other writers like Nick Hornby or David Nichols, because I guess there's a very small pool of men who write about love and relationships like this. And it's a great shame, I think, Jonathan. Why don't you think more blokes write stories about love and relationships?
I think they do. They just might not publish them. I don't know, to be honest. I think that is starting to change. I think you're right. I think London, for whatever reason, has always had that kind of attachment to it, in the same way that I guess Paris does for, you know, fiction, you know, primarily written by women in that kind of vein. But London, I mean, Love Actually, I think about as well, which is like really formative, that came out when I was 13 years old, you know, and I remember watching that and just being, I think I watch it every year, like without doubt. And a lot of people hate Love Actually. And there's a lot of problematic aspects of Love Actually if you watch it in 2024 as opposed to when it came out. But there is something about London, about the transient nature of the city, about the way in which people move and the happenstance and the ways in which people can fall in and out of love just by circumstance, that you just don't get in other cities. In answer to your question about why there aren't more male writers writing about love and writing about romance, I think there are. We've obviously got Trent Dalton here, who's doing a pretty amazing job, but it's a vulnerability thing. In my family, we just say how we feel, and I think we've just grown up like that, and maybe, you know, it's come through from my parents, but that's never been something to shy away from. And I'm someone who, as I said, has a box full of love letters from when he was 12, so I guess it was always in the stars for me.
I Googled quite a lot of things while I was reading this book, including the cast of the TV show The Sopranos. There is a cameo in this novel by the actor Michael Imperioli. People will know him for playing Christopher on The Sopranos, but also for Dominic in The White Lotus. Tell me about the decision to include a real actor in your piece of fiction.
Bananas. I remember my agent... My agent read it and she was like, right, well, we're going to have to get him for the TV show. And I said, I don't think he's doing anything anymore, because at that point, when I originally wrote this book, which was a couple of years ago, it was before, I guess, the Imperioli Renaissance, which has been happening of late. And the last thing anybody had seen him in was in The Sopranos, which was ages ago. So I was like, this, you know, this could be kind of cute and funny. You know, I always thought he was just such a magnetic character and so interesting. And I just love that he is kind of like this foil to Enzo. He's also, you know, an Italian style character who almost like comes to life out of this TV show that they've been watching together. And I've read a few books where like real life characters or real life people come into them. And I think if you can do it well, it just really elevates it and does something for you, because everyone has that association. I have no idea. You know, I mean, maybe he'll read it, maybe he'll love it, maybe he'll be like, I want to option it. You know, I have no idea. But yeah, he's back on the scene in a big way. He's in a rock band. He runs a meditation podcast. So I am here for it. you know, maybe I'll get his, it was Adriana. I think that was his girlfriend in the show. I don't know what she's been doing, but not much from what I understand. So maybe we can get the whole gang back together. That would be great.
Does it feel, I mean, he's got a cameo appearance in this book, but does it feel risky to put someone you don't know and just put them in your novel?
I don't know. I read very widely and I read a lot of really out there stuff. And this to me is not that out there. You know, I see people kind of like writing like huge levels of fan fiction into their books and getting away with it. People writing entire short stories about Taylor Swift, people doing all kinds of things. So for me, I don't know. I'm a culture journalist. When I'm not writing books, I kind of live in this world. I write about music. I write about film and culture all the time. I think the idea that those things have to remain distinct from one another is a bit antiquated in this day and age. And it just makes it more fun. It's a bit more, you know, intertextual, as my high school English teacher used to like to say.
You mentioned your music life. I also had to look up a song after reading this book. The song's called Valentine. It's by Jessie Ware and Sampha. I have to admit, I listened to the song and then I listened again straight away because it's a pretty amazing song. Tell me a little bit about your music life and tell me about this song and why this song appears in this book.
It's so beautiful, isn't it?
It was gorgeous.
I tried to get that song cleared so we could have a vinyl to go with the book to come out at the same time as the book. And I got 90% there, but we didn't get there, which retrospectively is probably good because I would just have to physically go into bookstores and give them vinyl and also explain what to do with it. But I have been a music journalist since I was 18. So, you know, a long time now, nearly 20 years. I have always been obsessed with music. I think it is the common ground for people who don't like sport, which is me. It's a great unifier for everybody. Everyone has an opinion about music. Everybody has music that they love. Everybody has music that they hate, but everybody has an opinion about music. But also, I just think that it can amplify a mood or a situation or a scene. And this comes again from watching films like Love Actually, but watching films in general, I really like to soundtrack the books that I write. And both this book and the last book have QR codes in the front and the back where you can basically scan and have a playlist that you can listen along with because of what you just said, which is that people will put down a book and Google something. And I always do that when I'm reading and it frustrates me that I lose the thread. Mm. So I really wanted to have it that you could technically be listening unless you're on an audiobook, in which case a disaster. But you could be listening to the music while reading about the music or while, you know, that reference to the music at the same time. And I thought that was really important. Sampha and Jessie Ware, they are, I guess, the titans of mid-2000s indie music in London. They got together with a producer called Subtract. They were just creating these songs, I guess, seemingly on the fly because none of them had really rich careers at that point and all of them then took off, particularly Jessie Ware, who is now huge and is like a kind of disco queen over in the UK, and Sampha, who I saw quite recently in Australia, and it was just transcendental. But this, it just feels like a real moment, and emotionally it has the pull. Like if this ever did get turned into a TV show, this would be the song that I would want to be in the credits. Mm. It just has, it's only 2 minutes. There's barely anything in it, but it's wonderful.
And the song is called Valentine. The book is called All the Beautiful Things You Love. It's by Jonathan Seidler and it's published by Pan Macmillan. Jonathan, what a pleasure it's been to chat to you today.
Thank you so much.
Now, I hope you've been following our new series on banned books in our podcast feed. So far, producer Sarah Lestrange has looked at book bans in the US and the case of the fatwa against Salman Rushdie for his fourth novel, The Satanic Verses. The latest episode in Banned Books is about the crackdown on homoerotic web fiction authors in China. Here's a taste.
My name is Liang Ge.
Chinese author Liang Ge has a secret.
Actually, I have a quite secret occupation. I'm also a boys' love writer.
Yes, that's right, a boys' love writer. It's also known as Dunmei fiction in China. And these authors are penning bromance and homoerotic fiction, manga and animation. It's a challenging time for them in China at the moment because some boys' love or Dunmei authors have been targeted by the police and even sent to jail for their sexually explicit fiction.
I published several books secretly, but I will not disclose my secret pen names here.
Some Dunmay or Boys Love authors, like Liang Ge, hide their true identity behind pen names because they fear being targeted by the police, even though the genre is not actually banned in China.
I have this concern all the time as a damn writer, and there's no a clear line between what is allowed and what is not allowed.
This is Banned Books. I'm Sarah Lestrange, and I'm taking a look at recent book bans around the world to try to put my finger on what it is about certain books that attracts the censors. In this episode, I'm focusing on China, which has a long history of censorship. And I'm going to tell you about the enormously popular web fiction trend, which has managed to evade the censors until now.
Make sure you follow the Book Show podcast so you don't miss any of these episodes. You can find us on the ABC Listen app. The Book Show is made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. It's produced by Sarah Lestrange and I'm Claire Nichols. Bye.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.